Okay. I'll go around and say hello to Linda with the PC. I don't know if there's another Linda here tonight. Remind me once again of the first letter of your last name.
R.
R. Linda R. All right. Thank you. And Paul? Mark? Jeff? Bob? Bridget? Susan? Jinryu? Marv? Who's making quite a lot of progress there? Sam? Karen? Jill? Gaffel? Shoketsu? Mick? Alice? Tessa? Amanda? Sabrina? Tyler? Sydney? John? Jim? Drew? And Ruth Ann. Sorry, Ruth Ann, you're always last because they put the phone last on the screen. Last but not least. All right. I don't think I have any particular announcements except for keep an eye out in your weekly email newsletter for what is coming up. Any questions or anything about what's coming up or anything? All right. So tonight we are continuing our foundational teaching series, and we're talking about the Four Noble Truths. This is like the one of the most foundational of Buddhist teachings. This was the Buddha's first teaching, according to the stories, mythology. So, it's the first Buddhist teaching that I encountered. I was taking a trip to India, and there's not a lot of Buddhism in India anymore, but it's part of the history. So I was reading the guidebook ahead of time to just learn about it. And, you know, there was just this little, the Buddha was born 2,500 years ago, whatever, and here's his basic teachings. And I was just so struck by the Four Noble Truths that, So the Buddha's, according in the Pali Canon at least, the Buddha's first teaching is called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, or the Setting the Wheel of Dhamma in Motion Sutta. So according to the mythology, he has the awakening. He actually waits a while. He's thinking, nobody's going to get this. I'm not going to teach it. But then the mythology goes that the gods beg him to teach. They say, some people will get it. Some people get it. So then he remembers these folks that he used to practice with, and he goes to share this teaching with them, and they awaken to the reality of it. So this is, I'm just going to read a short bit from it. He says, now this monks, because he was speaking to these monastics that he used to practice with. Now this monks is the noble truth of stress. So this is a translation by Tanisiro Bhikkhu, and he translates dukkha, which we're going to talk about more, as stress. A lot of times it's translated as suffering or dissatisfactoriness, that kind of thing. So, but he translates it as stress. Now this monks is the noble truth of stress. Birth is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are stressful. Association with the unbeloved is stressful. Separation from the loved is stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. So this is like the five aggregates or five skandhas are all the different aspects of our experience. Body, sensations, perceptions, ideas, and formations. And when they involve clinging, which we will get to, clinging or craving, then they cause suffering or dukkha, stress. So then that's the first noble truth, that stress exists. Dukkha exists. Dukkha happens. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the origination of stress. That is the craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now here, now there, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, craving for non-becoming. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of stress, the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very craving. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the way of practice, leading to the cessation of stress. Precisely this noble eightfold path. Right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So that's it, short and sweet. So, you know, when I first encountered this, I just thought it was so remarkable that Buddhism from the outset just says, you know, life is marked by stress. Life is marked by dissatisfactoriness. It seemed like most other, religious traditions and or ways that human beings had tried to address the issues of the world tried to say that's not the way it should be. If you're experiencing it that way, you know, you're missing out on something, or let's hope for better after death or something like that, where Buddhism says, all right, here we are. Life is, and actually I even feel like there was a fair amount of denial of dukkha and stress. So if you're feeling dukkha and stress, there's something wrong with you. Not that this is a universal human problem, regardless of our circumstances. So that this classic story, of course, is that the Buddha experienced this even though he was living in luxury. So it has nothing to do with the conditions of your life. This is part of being human, is that we experience this stress. But there's something that we can do about it. And there's an actual path of practice so that we can do something about it. So that to me was also just amazingly revolutionary, right? It's one thing to kind of philosophize about, well, we feel stress because we resist the way things are. We don't want things to be impermanent. We want things to be able to grasp and hold on to things, and we can't. And if we just didn't wish it was that way, we wouldn't suffer. Okay, but you know, that's not that easy. What do you do about that? Just stop. I mean, theoretically you can, but it's actually not that easy. So then there's this whole path of practice. Like the fourth noble truth is like, that's the rest of Buddhism. that is meditation. That's chanting. That's ethical conduct. That's texts. That's art. That is sangha. That's ceremonies. Everything else that we do is a path that is trying to help us liberate us from suffering. So I want to point out that the Buddhist teachings and these early ones in particular are kind of like either a fractal or a kaleidoscope. So it can be a little mind-bending and confusing, but if you just let it, okay, it's just kind of the same stuff mixed up in different ways. Because and we're going to get to the Eightfold Path, but the right view in the Eightfold Path, which is considered a critical piece of the Eightfold Path, right view is really getting the Four Noble Truths. And in the Four Noble Truths, the Fourth Noble Truth is the Eightfold Path. So they just kind of like loop back on one another. So the Four Noble Truths, so we're going to go more into dukkha and craving and what this stuff means, but I want to present the Four Noble Truths as it's kind of unfortunate that we call them the Four Noble Truths, because that ends up making it sound like, all right, well, here's the four facts, and if you're a Buddhist, you just, you know, you accept these facts, or kind of like the Apostles' Creed or something. Like, we would all just, okay, here we stand together as Buddhists, and we believe that life is marked by dukkha, and we believe that it can stop. But how they're meant to be approached. There are things that we need to investigate or need to, I mean, we can choose to, right? If we want to follow the path of Buddhist practice, if we want to explore liberation from suffering, from stress, from dissatisfactoriness, these are things that we need to explore and verify for ourselves, to investigate. So it's really more like, if you are able to see each of these things for yourself, it leads to liberation from suffering. So we need to truly, truly explore and comprehend them. And if we're just accepting them at face value, then they're not actually that useful. So before I go on to dukkha, the nature of dukkha, any questions? Feel free to either unmute yourself or do the little, you can do a reaction raised hand and I'll call on you, which you can do at any point throughout the class too. All right. So it all hinges on this concept of dukkha, which in popular culture, I think is the most misunderstood. I don't know, enlightenment's probably misunderstood as well, but it's probably one of the most misunderstood aspects of Buddhism. It's often translated as suffering. And so it's proposed that, okay, well, Buddhists think life is suffering, or the Buddha taught that life is suffering. And to be honest, that's not all that far off the mark. There was a view at the time, you know, of rebirth and samsara, of the sense that we're all going to be reborn countless times, and even if have a fortunate birth, then eventually we're not going to have a fortunate birth, and we just kind of go around and around, and we're ignorant every time. So there is a overtone of that, not to be denied, but the way that we don't have to buy all that, this is still useful. And the useful way to look at it is that life involves pain, and we would prefer that it not involve pain, emotional and physical pain, mental pain, those kinds of difficulties. It involves pain, and there's not a whole lot that can be done about that. Buddhism can't really do anything about that either. But that's different from dukkha or suffering or dissatisfactoriness. That is something we add to things that happen. We make things worse. with our own minds, with our own resistance, with our own narratives, with our own catastrophizing, our own taking it personally, all of these ways that we make a difficult thing much worse. And there's a, I'm going to share two different early Buddhist teachings tonight that have to do with arrows, using arrows as an analogy. So this is the one that fits first, and it's the story of the two arrows in the Salata Sutta. So he said, but the Buddha says, now the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones, which hopefully we all aspire to be, when touched with a feeling of pain, does not sorrow, grieve, or lament, does not beat her breast or become distraught. So she feels one pain, physical, but not mental. And I would say like emotional as well, but not as additional. Just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow and right afterward did not shoot him with another one, so he would feel the pain of only one arrow. And this paragraph is in contrast to the previous one, which was somebody who isn't instructed in the way, in the path. It's like they get shot with one arrow and then they get shot with a second one. So we get shot with one arrow, we end up with an illness that really, you know, is painful and difficult and scary and impacts our life. That's painful. But there's a lot of ways that we can react to that where we can make it a lot worse, right? We can just dwell in the future and think about fear. We can dwell in the past and think about all that we've lost. We can compare ourselves to others. We can, dwell on why me. We can, I don't think everybody can imagine the ways that you could make it worse. And a lot worse at times. So to go on, he says, as this person who's been shot with an arrow, but is a disciple of the noble ones, she is touched by that painful feeling, but she is not resistant. No resistance, obsession with regard to that painful feeling obsesses her. Touched by that painful feeling, she does not delight in sensual pleasure. So even though, so there's a painful, but it's, she's not craving pleasure. She's not craving the opposite of that. She's not craving, oh, please make this, you know, I'm longing for this pain not to be there. And why is that? Because the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones does not discern an escape from painful feeling because they discern an escape from painful feeling aside from sensual pleasure. So most of the time we just think, if I'm in this difficult circumstance, the only way that I can be happy is if this difficult circumstance ends, or I'm in pleasure instead of pain, or comfort instead of pain, or I'm have fortunate circumstances instead of unfortunate. That's the only way that I can be happy. But the practitioner knows that there is a way to be happy, to be at ease, that isn't conditional on those circumstances changing. That's not to say they don't want the circumstances to change. We still want our pain or illness or misfortune to go away, but we're not counting on that for our happiness. So there's another arrow story I want to share before we go on, and that is that in a way, Buddhism is extremely pragmatic. So even though we want to be mindful and understand things and understand ourselves, ultimately we're looking to like, all right, what do we do now? what is it that we can act or do to improve the situation, to improve our relationship to it? And this is illustrated by, this is the shorter exhortation to Malunkya Kula. Anyway, I think of it as the questions that do not tend to edification sutta. So it's just as if a man were wounded with an arrow thickly smeared with poison. His friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives would provide him with a surgeon. And the man would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether the man who wounded me was a noble warrior, a Brahmin, a merchant, or a worker. He would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know the given name and clan name of the man who wounded me, until I know whether he was tall, medium, or short, until I know whether he was dark, ruddy brown, or golden colored, until I know his home, village, town, or city, until I know whether the bow with which I was wounded was a longbow or a crossbow. And it goes on. That man will die, and those things would still remain unknown to him. So this is really asking us to focus on what's most important. And a lot of times in the midst of our in the midst of the difficulties that we face in life, we can end up going down a lot of rabbit holes with them. How did this happen? Why did this happen? How am I to blame? Why doesn't this happen to other people? I don't know. That's just a few examples. Basically the Buddha would say, if it's not leading toward wisdom or an improvement in your state of mind, to progress on the path toward alleviating the suffering, then it's a waste of time, frankly. So a note on craving. So part of the noble truth is that dukkha arises, and sometimes it says it's just desire. But I would say that there's a usefulness in differentiating between desire, which is just kind of something I think of more desire. And so it's really just a term of kind of a matter of semantics and words and stuff. But I think of desire as being kind of just a natural preference that arises. If you feel pain, how would it not desire to feel free of the pain? And we desire to be comfortable, we desire to that our loved ones are happy and well. So, and that's not really such a problem if it just remains at that level of just, of course, naturally we would prefer for things to be nice and comfortable. But there's it's a matter of degree in a way, when it moves to craving. So this is, of course, it's tied up again to kind of into what we talked about in previous weeks about a sense of self. Sometimes a sense of self gets tied up into having to have something or have something happen. And it ups the ante. Now, whatever it is has to happen, or whatever it is has to stop. There begins to be a sense of imperative around whatever is happening, or around whatever it is that we want to have happen. And that's where the dukkha starts to arise. Assuming, of course, that our circumstances are not, meeting our desires, right? They're meeting our cravings. So I don't know what's springing to mind. It's just, we have a natural desire, most of us, for intimacy, to have a nice, relationship with with friends or with a partner that is supportive and loving. But there are some folks for whom, like, they, for one reason or another, they do not have that. And it's a huge main obsession of their life, a huge source of pain and angst. And, you know, if they don't have that relationship and they're constantly looking for that relationship, it's just a great source of suffering. It's like you can, so it's a tricky thing. It's not easy, right? That's why we have the path of practice. How do you want that and yet not succumb to craving it and thereby causing yourself suffering? So, and that craving is like, that's the, you know, that's shooting yourself with the second arrow. There might be a longing right there, longing for something. But do you need to shoot yourself with the second arrow? So questions or comments there? Yeah, go ahead.
So how do you not shoot yourself with the second arrow?
I mean, that is an awesome question. And I think that really is, that is what we're trying to discover over the path of practice. So, you know, that's what we study in our, and I wouldn't say we study it in our meditation, but our meditation, which we'll kind of get to with the Eightfold Path, our meditation changes our relationship to life in a way that we're more receptive to being able to see other possibilities, see other relationships to things, to start to melt away and soften that sense of self that is so problematic. So there's that. There's also the precept practice. And I feel like there's, you know, another saying is that to study Buddhism is to study the self. That's a Zen saying by Dogen. And that, I feel like that's part of it. Through meditation, through precept practice, through just mindfulness of trying to be aware, turning the light and shining it inward. And what is my response to this? And when I do this, what is the result? How do I feel when I turn my mind this way? So it's like we become scientists in a sense, and the subject is ourselves. And we really try to get more and more familiar with our own behavior, because like I talked about, I think two classes ago, in the Buddha's enlightenment experience, that's what he did. He turned the light inward and he watched his own mind. And that's how he discovered the Four Noble Truths, or this way of formulating practice. He said, now when I think like this, that there's suffering. And when I don't think like that, then there's no suffering. So it's a long, prolonged, grueling process in a way of just, you know, watching our own minds and behaviors, seeing which things lead to suffering and which don't. And when you notice something leads to suffering, it's not necessarily so easy, right? Just like, oh, well, I'll let that go. But I guess I kind of feel like, you know, we can let it go. It might not be that easy to let it go. But once we realize, oh, there's something I'm holding on to here. All right, I'm causing myself suffering. So you may not be able to change the situation immediately, but eventually you might find something. Oh, I don't have to think that. I don't have to act like that. So some opening can happen, that a change in our thinking and behavior occurs to us, and then we get to try it out and see what happens. Great question.
Yomiel, can I ask a question? You already touched on it. This is to try to connect last week to this week, but what I was thinking when you touched on the self thing briefly was sometimes the text described our main problem is this, you know, building you know, I am these things, I am this experience, or I am not, or I own it, you know, it mm-hmm. is mine. And then sometimes it's the problem is we're dragged around by our aversions and desires and constantly this no and yes all the time. So are those just two ways of describing the same thing, or that's part of that sort of kaleidoscope aspect you were talking about?
I would say yes, it's part of the kaleidoscope, in the sense that, like, sometimes in some teachings this comes to the fore, in some teachings that comes to the fore, in other teachings they're formulated in a different way. So there's like the 12-fold chain of dependent origination, which accounts for like the arising of all the whole mess, including our birth and death, right? So like there's ignorance of the true nature of self, and then we have sense contact, and then there's like aversion arises, and then that builds and it comes craving, and then we have a sense of wanting to become and grow, and then we generate karma and all this kind of stuff. So I guess in short, it's the self, that sense of self-identification is behind what takes that pretty simple desire and pumps it up into craving. Because it's that self-interest that makes it into craving. Our concern for ourselves, our desire, our fear, which is all very self-referential. But in the Four Noble Truths, it's not necessarily going to be talking about the self, but yeah. Cool. Well, let me go on to the Eightfold Path. I mean, we could probably spend a whole class on the Four Noble Truths, but the Eightfold Path is pretty rich too. And I wanted to do a breakout on this. So the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path. So like I was saying, Buddhism doesn't just give you an ideal and say, this is how you should act. A good Buddhist would act like this. It says, you know, here's how you can work on that. And so there's that list of right understanding, right intention, right speech. And once again, language is tricky here. Right, for many of us, myself, certainly for myself, sounds kind of judgmental. Sounds kind of like morally, you know, right versus you are wrong. That's wrong understanding. That is wrong behavior. But the way that it's meant to be taken, so I imagine this isn't an exact analogy, because, you know, Sanskrit to English, who knows, Pali to English. But another way to think about it is, like, you could say, this is the right key for that door. Right meaning it's what works. It fits. It's like kind of the correct key for that door in a very pragmatic, functional way. So from a Buddhist perspective, then, would say, if you want to walk the Buddhist path, if you want to cultivate wisdom and liberate yourself and others from suffering, here's the right way to do it. This is what works. This is the, you know, right speech versus speech that's probably not going to get you very far along the path. So the eight different aspects are not, so it's not a path like you go one step at a time. Sometimes it's portrayed as a wheel with eight spokes. So they're all aspects of the path that we cultivate or practice. And there are three categories, three parts. One is discernment. So that's right understanding and right intention, which I'll say a little bit more about. There is ethical conduct. So that's the right speech, right action, right livelihood. And then mental discipline, kind of practice, if you will. That's right effort, right mindfulness and right concentration. So, I was going to share this written version with you all. So if you wouldn't mind letting me pull up the list of eight of the eight, so you can refer to it. Classes. It's amazing how difficult it can be to browse your computer when you have 20 people looking at you. Let's see. Okay, so let me drop this list in a Google document that then I can share and let you see. Okay. All right. Can you see that? Make the text a little bigger. All right. You can see? Cool. All right. So let's see, right understanding. Specifically, like I said, this understanding, any kind of understanding is useful, right? Any kind of insight into what's going on, what might help. But in the context of the Eightfold Path, it's particularly understanding the Four Noble Truths. It's understanding the nature of dukkha. It's understanding how we cause it to arise, understanding how we might be able to let it go, and then understanding the path. We've got that fractal thing going on again. Right intention is the determination to do what's necessary to end suffering for self and other. So in a way, if you figure, if you didn't even have the intention... practice can be really hard, right? But if you didn't have the intention to sit, your meditation's going to be terrible, right? If you never even intend to sit, you never even intend to do ethical behavior, you never even intend to pay attention, well, then, so this intention piece is very necessary. And it's also the intention to do what is necessary, which might be renouncing something, right? You might realize that this behavior or this relationship or this, the use of this intoxicant or something like that is really, this is causing suffering. And if I really aspire to end suffering for self and other, then I will give it up, even if it might be kind of hard to give it up. Right. Speech, action, and livelihood is a little more straightforward. So speech, there's very specific, lots of very specific teachings about right speech in Buddhism, but generally speaking, it's truthful, beneficial, kind, and skillful. So we all know that there's a lifetime of work to be done on right speech. And action is the physical aspects of ethical conduct, not killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. I think it's really cool and fascinating that Buddhism has right livelihood as one of its core principles. So I think this emphasizes that from the very beginning, lay people have been an important part of Buddhism, and that monks also need to think about how are they earning their keep, right? Are they earning their keep by lying or promoting themselves, or are they, sincerely sharing the Dharma? So supporting self and family in ways that don't cause pain and suffering. And then the mental discipline or kind of practice aspects, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration or meditation. So effort and intention kind of go side by side, right? You might have an intention, but if you don't summon the energy and the diligence necessary to follow through, then that will be lacking. And right mindfulness, you know, I will do a whole class. I think the next class is on mindfulness. So it means to, kind of means presence of mind. So this can happen at any time. We're just aspiring to pay attention, paying attention to what is going on around us and within us. And again, like do if just holding, it can be difficult to do, but just holding that intention to do that makes a big difference. I don't know if anybody has noticed, like, I mean, some people just based on their personality will be more attentive, but this is something that can be cultivated, right? So if you are a Buddhist practitioner, you might find yourself in spaces with other folks and you will just notice things that everybody else is oblivious to. You know, whether that's something that's fallen on the floor, somebody that's being excluded from a conversation, you know, but maybe small things that other people are just like, well, whatever, they're in their conversation or they're thinking about something else, absorbed in their thoughts, and learning to pay more attention is a striking feature. And then right concentration or meditation. So like I said, spending time in our meditation practice in order to open up to different aspects of our experience. So what I wanted to do was briefly have people go into breakout rooms and look through the list, which I can also, I think I can paste it in the chat, and then some of you at least will be able to see it in the chat.
Can I ask a question before we go into breakout?
Yeah.
And there's a question in the chat related to what I'm asking.
Oh, you're muted again.
I don't know why I did that. My question is particular to right speech, which in your definitions had to do with kind and so many other things, including skillful, which to me, I mean, I understand skillful means, but sometimes that word sounds manipulative to me. And then there was a question in the chat about a better understanding of what right means.
So it says, does right equal skillful? I guess I would think that right, the way that I think about it, is the right is a little more broad than that. Because you wouldn't say, is it skillful meditation? I mean, skillful in a Buddhist context means something quite specific, which means you are interacting with other people and you're trying to help. and there are ways that you could speak or act that wouldn't be helpful. And there's ways you could speak and act which would be helpful. And you are adjusting your approach based on who you're dealing with. So I think, yeah, I mean, there is that kind of like, well, you know, who are you to be trying to talk skillfully to me? but I think it's that, you know, what is motivation? If I have an agenda and I'm trying to be skillful with you, then I'm just being manipulative. But if I am a true bodhisattva, I only have your best interests in mind. Yeah, I think appropriate is a good alternative to the word right. Appropriate, helpful, skillful, all those kinds of things. So I wanted to give people a little chance to talk about the different aspects of the path. And I think some of you, when you go into a breakout room, are still going to be able to see this chat. But I will also come to the different rooms and paste it into your chat if you can't see it. And I decided to go down the list and I come up with one example for each of like something very concrete that you might have done in the last week that has to do with cultivating or practicing this aspect of the path. You know, within the last week, in order to cultivate right understanding, just to kind of take this kind of lofty list and put it into concrete terms. But if there is is one of the aspects of the path that it's like, what intention? I'm not sure. Then just come up with a question for that aspect of the path. So we don't have a lot of time, unfortunately, but I'll give you about 10 minutes and then we'll come back and do a brief report back and hopefully I can answer a couple of the questions. So let me see. I will invite you. Well, not much chance to report back or ask any questions. I just made a note to myself on my little class notes. It says, Four Noble Truths should be one class and Eightfold Path should be another class. But I was trying to squeeze this in between like the end of the Norman Fisher book and the beginning of the precepts. But there's a lot here. And I heard a lot of really great questions come up in our group. So I think next week is mindfulness, but you know, I have no objection to if there's kind of follow-up questions and issues and stuff from this class, we can certainly spend some time on that at the beginning. So hopefully in your rooms you had shared some interesting things. So I will close with dedicating the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Have a good rest of your evening or day or wherever you are.
Thank you, Jamiel.
Good night.
Thanks,
everyone.
Thank you. Thank you. Sweet dreams.
You too. Perfect.